Hi, it's Diane. On my mind.
For guys, the mixed message is, you know, at once that they should be scrupulous about consent and that they should be respectful to women, but also that the measure of a man is still sexual conquest.
Boys and Sex. That's the title of the new book by best-selling author Peggy Orenstein. For decades, Orenstein has written about the mixed messages society gives girls about everything from wearing pink and looking pretty to how they should think about rape, pregnancy, and sexual pleasure. In her latest work, she turns her attention to young men. Orenstein spoke to more than 100 boys to hear their views on hookup culture, relationships, porn, and navigating what she calls the new masculinity. Peggy Orenstein joined me in the studio. Peggy, first tell me about your research, who you chose to talk to, and why this topic is so important.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I never thought I would write about boys. It was not on my to-do list. I've been writing about girls for 25 years, and I have loved doing that. But after my last book came out, Girls and Sex, everywhere I went, people would say, when are you going to write about boys? And I would think, well, somebody else's job, really. But the more I thought about it, you know, nobody was talking to boys about sex and intimacy, and nobody was listening to them. And I'd been in the trenches of adolescent sexuality for a long time. And so I thought I would give it a try. And then as I was thinking about that, the Me Too movement launched. And suddenly, you know, just the extent of sexual misconduct across every sector of society became so obvious. And, you know, there is an imperative now to reduce sexual violence. But it also felt to me like a real opportunity to engage boys, really for the first time, in important conversations about sex, about intimacy, about gender. And so I went out and started talking to boys, and I talked to over 100 guys between about the ages of 16 and 22 who were
perfect age.
Yeah, right in that spot of starting out. Either college bound or in college, that was the demographic. But other than that, different backgrounds, different sexual orientations all across the country, and really just wanted to hear what they would have to say, because we need to know in order to help them best guide their decision making.
And of course, they don't necessarily have the best role models out there, with the likes of Harvey Weinstein, with our own president.
Yeah, there's that. But that has also, I think, really given an opportunity, because those sort of examples are such negative examples. But I also worry that when we talk about people like Weinstein, that we start thinking that everyone who assaults is a monster and only monsters assault. And that's not true. And that blinds us to the larger issue of the culture that boys grow up in that urges them towards disconnection in their experience, and that can result in assault, doesn't necessarily result in assault, but that, you know, the kind of everyday garden variety coercion and disrespect that a lot of good guys engage in, because good guys can do bad things.
You found that young men in this age group are watching a lot of porn.
Yeah, that's true. There's so much porn, Diane. I never asked a boy whether he had seen porn, because that would have shot my credibility to hell. I would always ask, when was the first time that you saw porn? And I want to be really clear about a few things. Curiosity about sex, obviously normal. Masturbation, natural and good. And even porn, there's all kinds of porn. There's ethical porn, there's feminist porn, there's queer porn. But that is not what boys are accessing, or girls. And what has changed is with the rise of the internet and the smartphone and the dropping of the paywall on sites like Pornhub starting in the mid-2000s, that allowed young people to access whatever you can imagine and anything, you know, a lot of things you don't want to imagine, free and right at their fingertips. So that's what's different. And that what they are accessing is a really, you know, consistently distorted picture of what sex is. They see something that men do to women instead of with them, that female pleasure is a performance for men. And, you know, again, if we aren't getting in there and talking to them about what's real and what's not real and what's missing in those images, you know, they're bringing those ideas into the bedroom. It's their de facto sex educator.
Of the young men you spoke with, how many had actually had some form of realistic sex education, either in school, from their parents, from a trusted adult, or how many just came at it through what their peers had to say, what these websites had to say? How did it break down?
It's such a good question, because basically there was very little sex education, very, very little. You know, they don't get it from schools. Most states still stress abstinence only, which, you know, abstinence is a fine option, but it should be one among many, not the only thing they hear about. And their parents say very little. Usually what guys would say was their parents said, don't get anybody pregnant, don't get a disease, and respect women. And the respect women piece, they would say, you know, the thing is, which women, under what circumstances? And one guy said, it's like saying, don't run over any little old ladies and then handing you the car keys. I mean, you never think you're going to run over a little old lady, but you still don't know how to drive.
Can the pornography that they turn to actually be helpful in some ways to these young men, especially if that conversation with the caring adult has not happened?
Well, there's evidence that pornography use liberalizes some ideas, like people who use porn were more pro-sex, same-sex marriage. But on the flip side, what we see with college guys when they've done research is that guys who use porn regularly, which in the research they defined as like a couple times a month, which made the guys that I talked to either pale or burst out laughing, they were less satisfied with their partnered interactions.
Why?
They were less satisfied with their own performance. They were less satisfied with their partner's bodies, with their own bodies. You know, one of the things one of the boys said to me that I found very poignant was that he felt that porn had kind of destroyed his ability, what he said was, to be innocent in a sexual relationship, to be able to explore and experience without preconceived ideas of what it was supposed to be. And I think, you know, you can talk about all the other stuff and the sexism and racism and anything else, but I think that that's for kids. That is huge. That is a huge, sad thing.
You talk in the book about humorous thinking going on about girls and women and how to approach them.
Yeah, well, I mean, guys are getting very mixed messages in the same way that I feel like girls were when I, and still are, but particularly were when I first started writing about girls in the 90s. And for guys, the mixed message is, you know, at once that they should be scrupulous about consent and that they should be respectful to women, but also that the measure of a man, of a real man, is still sexual conquest and that they should try to hook up, you know, have as they say, sex without feelings, you know, with as many people as possible.
Sex without feelings.
Of course, there's no such thing as without, but yes, sex without feelings. When I speak to young people, I often get asked, how do you have sex without feelings? Can you have sex without feelings? That's the kind of ideal that they are being presented with.
Why?
Isn't that a good question? Well, that's what the media is telling them is fun and desirable. And I think with boys, I really felt that at the heart of this book, they're wrestling with the idea of human vulnerability. And you know, they still, even though so much has opened up to them and there's been changes in the culture, they still so much define manhood through emotional suppression. And they would talk to me about, you know, putting up a wall or training themselves not to feel, or a boy who, when his parents divorced, couldn't cry, so he streamed three Holocaust movies back to back. You know, and that worked. And there's so, what they would say was, there allowed happiness and anger, and everything else had to go behind that wall. And when we socialize boys, when we raise boys to, you know, suck it up or be a man, or even a lot of the guys would say, my dad wasn't sexist, he wasn't homophobic, but he was more of a sigh and walk away kind of guy. And I learned that stunted side of masculinity from that. They were pretty insightful about it. But when we cut boys off from their vulnerability, when we narrow that range of feeling and emotion and ability to acknowledge and even recognize any feeling besides happiness and anger, they are cut off from not only, you know, fundamental humanity, but the very thing they need in order to establish and sustain a successful relationship.
Successful relationships, those two words and the word hookup don't seem to me compatible.
Kids do, you know, they do have what we think of as relationships, but there's two pieces to that whole idea of the hookup. The word hookup is a meaningless word. So it can mean kissing, it can mean groping, it can mean oral sex, it can mean intercourse. You never know. And it's intentionally ambiguous that way, so that nobody really knows what you've done, which allows people to kind of overestimate maybe what your experience is, but also their own inexperience. And that's where it gets into trouble, that kids think that their peers are doing things that they're not actually doing. And then that puts pressure on them to perhaps engage in unwanted sex or perhaps push a little harder than they might ordinarily or want to in a sexual encounter. Hookup culture, by contrast, and, you know, casual sex, obviously, they didn't invent it. But the idea of hookup culture is that sex precedes intimacy rather than being a product of intimacy. And that the path to a relationship that's been normalized is that it starts with a hookup, even though most hookups won't end up in relationships.
That seems mighty confusing for a young person.
I think it really is. And it's not surprising that by the time they're in college, 85% of students express ambivalence about hookup culture. And there's a real disconnect between their perception and the reality, that they think their friends, their peers, all want to be involved in hookup culture, and it's just them who doesn't. In one chapter in Boys and Sex, I go into a freshman pregame party, which is the party before the party where they knock back a few shots in preparation for going and knocking back a few shots. And I was, you know, in the dorm room because that's not at all awkward for me. and having, you know, a conversation with the kids while this party was going on. And then I went back the next day and we sat around, some of us, and talked about hookup culture, what happened that night. You know, none of them had actually, I think, gone home with anybody, but we had this discussion. And at the end, they said, could we talk about this again next week?
Huh.
And, you know, I said, well, you can. I don't live in the dorm. Yeah. So no. But over and over, I felt I ran into that sense of young people, and this was the hope and the excitement about this book, young people being so ready and so desirous of real conversation with the adults in their lives and even with one another about these issues. And that's, you know, that's what I hope, both in Boys and Sex and Girls and Sex, what I wanted to provide was something that adults can look at to think, see how kids are thinking and talk about, and also that kids themselves
exactly.
can look at and maybe open more meaningful dialogue, you know, with one another as well as in their own heads.
What is the dialogue that goes on among boys about girls in regard to sex?
So again, you know, that masculinity piece, that idea that you're invulnerable, that wall that you have to put up, also means that, you know, you're engaging in what we all now know is, you know, the kind of locker room talk that we hear about in the news. And so when you hear how boys talk about sex,
yeah.
you know,
and
they
talk
hammer.
Talk about girls.
Yeah. They hammer, they nail, they pound, they bang. You know, it's like they've been to a construction site, not like they're engaging in an act of intimacy. And it's about a competition with other boys. It's not about the engagement with the girl. And the boys that I was talking to were not necessarily happy with that. They didn't necessarily think that was like great or fine or indifferent or dismiss it even as locker room talk. And one boy, in fact, who was, I don't mean to stereotype, but he seemed like the prototypical jock. And his name was Cole. And Cole and his friend tried to challenge some older boys in the locker room who were speaking poorly, disgustingly about women, and they mocked them and they laughed at them. And so the next time it happened, Cole's friend continued to speak up, but Cole stayed silent. And he said, as he watched this happen, that he watched the other boys you know, not like this other guy as much and not take him seriously and make fun of him. And he said he lost all his social capital while Cole was sitting there. And he said, I had buckets of it, but I wasn't spending it. And then he looked at me with real, like, sadness and kind of agony in his eyes. And he said, I don't want to have to choose between my own dignity and being part of the team, being part of these guys. But how do I make it so I don't have to choose?
And how are the girls behaving in the face of this kind of culture? How did they react to it?
Well, they don't like it. but, you know, I in Girls and Sex, I talk a lot more about that. And in hookup culture, I felt that girls and boys both could have that philosophy that just want to get drunk and hook up and you know, be disconnected and all of that. And girls and boys both didn't like it. You know, there were girls and boys on both sides of that fence. But when girls were unhappy with it, they tended to express more anger, betrayal, trauma. And guys, it was more confusion and just feeling like they were being ill-served, but they didn't know exactly how to articulate that or what to do about it.
So on college campuses, I would presume that there are certain numbers of counselors ready to talk to guys if those guys wanted to talk.
Right. And that's a hard sell. You know, one of the boys that I talked to said that his girlfriend had cheated on him. And so he said, so I just forgot about her. I just forgot about her. And he snapped his fingers. And the thing was, no, he didn't. Right? His schoolwork spiraled. He got depressed. He said everything that, you know, was fun for him suddenly didn't seem fun anymore. And he said he tried to go to a counselor, but talking about feelings felt weird. So he stopped. So finally he went home for Thanksgiving break. And he said he had what he described as a breakdown in front of his mom, who just said, you know, spill it. And he talked to his mom because the person that he would have confided in would have been his girlfriend. And she was gone. And so the thing about that I really considered was, I think a lot of times boys do confide in their moms if they're going to confide in anybody. And I think that feels really good to a mother for obvious reasons. But
does it have to be the mother who opens that conversation?
Right. And well, whether the boy starts it or whether the mother starts it, what tends to happen is that moms process boys' feelings for them instead of helping them learn to identify and work through their feelings on their own. And it can reinforce that idea that women are there to do the emotional labor of men. And I think that a lot of us know that that has some not so pleasant ramifications in our adult relationships. So I think we really need to think, particularly with little boys, this is something you can really start with little boys, about helping them name and express the range of feelings, the range of human emotion. You know, even in infancy, we talk more about emotion to girls than boys. Mothers talk more to their daughters. They use more emotional language. So saying to little boys things like, you know, that must feel sad, or, you know, that's frustrating, isn't it? Like giving things a name so that everything that's in that bucket doesn't go to anger, because basically, that's where boys learn that it should go.
You talk in the book about gay relationships, mm-hmm. and how they may have a language that's more suited to mutual understanding than boys and girls.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? It was one of the things that really struck me about gay boys was that they were kind of a model. Not to say that nothing, you know, they also talked about, you know, lousy relationships or disconnection or assault or bad communication, but they were could really presented a model of how to talk about and negotiate the terms of a sexual encounter. And what Dan Savage, who's a sex columnist, says, and he's gay, is that guys use the four magic words, which is, what are you into? And what is lovely about that is that it's a really open-ended question. And so often when boys and girls or women and men get to that moment of consent, it becomes a series of, if at all, kind of prescribed questions that one person, usually the guy, is asking the girl and wants a simple yes or no to, instead of creating a mutually gratifying, creative relationship with one another.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Now here's the rest of my conversation with Peggy Ornstein. She's the author of 7 books, including Girls and Sex, Cinderella Ate My Daughter, and her latest, Boys and Sex. Sexuality is all around these young men. I mean, it's so available. It's so non-necessarily nurturing. It's just out there.
Yeah.
And people talk about it, people laugh about it, people turn away from it, and yet these kids are facing it without necessarily having the tools to deal with.
Exactly. So they're steeped in a culture that shows transactional sex, that shows commodified sex. Every day they're seeing that, every day, multiple times a day. And one thing I thought a lot about was, you know, as somebody who has written a lot about girls, was that we've really recognized how harmful so many of those messages are to our daughters.
Exactly.
And we have, and you and I have talked about it over the course of many times that I've been here, and we have done a better job. It's not perfect, but we've done a better job of helping our daughters see through that and helping our daughters recognize the harm of those messages and resist those messages and contextualize those messages. Boys grow up in the same culture and worse. And we're not saying anything to them to help them understand and have a bit of a distance and a critique and know the difference between what they're seeing and what reality is. So that's another place where I feel like that's not that hard. I mean, I understand talking about sex, you'd rather poke yourself in the eye with a fork than talk to your son about sex. I know, but it's not just about that. It's about all these other things too.
Did you find differences either racially, culturally, among the boys that you talked to in terms of their attitudes about sex?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, masculinity is not masculinity is not masculinity, and all the things that, you know, come into play, class, race, sexual orientation, all affect how boys see these things and how boys see one another. So I particularly looked at African-American boys and Asian-American boys, and the guys that I looked at were a specific group. They were in sort of largely white schools. So it felt very much like they were flip sides of a coin where white masculinity was sort of controlling the toss. And the African-American boys would talk about feeling hypersexualized and like you were the coolest dude in the room, but you also could be seen as the dumbest dude in the room. You were hypersexualized and fetishized as like this object of desire, but also at any minute you might be taken down and seen as a predator. There was a huge psychological toll on them for living with that anxiety. And they would say things like, one guy said, you know, I'm not going to go to some frat party and get drunk with a bunch of white kids because anything can happen. And if I'm the only black guy in the room, I'm the only black guy in the room.
Yeah.
And then on the other side, Asian American guys would talk about feeling like they weren't seen as masculine, like they were seen as asexual, like they were marginalized and not desired. And I remember one guy who was using Tinder, the, you know, the swipe dating app, that he matched with a girl. They went back and forth for a while, and she said, well, you know, we could be friends, but no offense, I don't date Asian guys. And he just looked at me and said, how exactly is that no offense? So thinking about, I mean, I feel that parents of boys of color know how to talk to their sons about racism, but in an overarching way for all of us, I think kids today, you know, they're very aware. They're usually very tuned into bias and racism and all kinds of social justice issues, but they seem to kind of leave that at the door when they're talking about sex and gender.
How about the fraternity culture? To what extent does that play into the education of boys of a college age?
You know, those all-male enclaves, whether you're talking about fraternities or sports, they can do great things. They can cultivate brotherhood. They can cultivate character. They can, you know, engage in healthy competition. They're fun. But they can also become crucibles for that worst kind of bro culture. And that, you know, the character building part can act as a smokescreen that allows that kind of bullying, that bonding, you know, as guys through degrading women. Hookup culture is obviously central to fraternity life. And I had one guy who told me he dropped out of his frat as a freshman in pledge class because they were what they call a higher tier frat. So it's sort of a more, you know, socially desirable frat. And they had the boys pair at mixers with lower tiered sororities so they could practice their hookups and their hookup moves before they got to the girls in the higher tier sororities.
Wow.
So he left. And even boys in sports, one of the things that really struck me was boys in sports who would drop out of those sports, not because they weren't good at them or didn't enjoy them, but because the culture of the team offended them and they didn't want to stay in that. Boys talked about that actually quite a bit. So there's that part. But I also think and know that yes, those all-male enclaves can be crucibles of, you know, sexism and misogyny, but they can also be forces for change. And there are programs like Coaching Boys into Men, which is a terrific program that leverages the power of coaches who are such mentors in boys' lives and can, you know, also be doing this kind of behavior. Or they can be establishing a different culture that makes a difference lifelong for boys and that those boys carry out and transmit to other boys. And so things like Coaching Boys into Men, they did a study where there was, a control group and a group that was doing the program, which was a very light intervention, a weekly discussion, 15 minutes with your coach about a different set of topics that were prescribed. Huh. And those boys, a few years later, had lower rates of sexual violence, higher rates of bystander intervention. Their language was different. It made a difference in how they moved forward.
You used the word transmit, and you made me think of the transmission of disease. Mm. To what extent do these kids think about that or worry about it?
That really varied. And we do know right now that disease rates among young people are at a high. The CDC keeps reporting that gonorrhea is very high, syphilis is very high, particularly among gay guys. Those diseases are rampant. So kids are not getting the message the way that they need to, that they need to be protecting against disease. And I think, you know, that's obviously a crucial and a baseline issue, but I do worry that when we talk to kids about sex, we emphasize risk and danger rather than talking from a perspective of personal responsibility and joy, which is a really big shift.
Absolutely. I'm curious as to how you were accepted in these circles. How did they feel about talking with you, a woman who has her own children, who has had experiences of her own, but is certainly not a woman of their age?
No. I think I have cool aunt status. That's my general stance. I'm the cool aunt. No, I was worried going in. That was one of my fears. I had two personal fears about switching over to talking to boys. The first was that they wouldn't talk because, you know, teenage boys don't have a reputation for chatting. That was completely unfounded. They were desperate to talk. They were eager to talk. They were hungry to talk. They were, you know, blunt. They were honest. They were candid because nobody ever asks them. The other piece was I worried about being a woman doing this. And I did do some interesting experimenting as a journalist this time. I would have boys interview their friends when I wasn't around or do other things to see how that might change the conversation or influence the conversation. But for the most part, I ended up feeling that whatever they may not have told me because I was a woman, there was something that they told me for that very reason. And that particularly these issues around vulnerability, confusion, fear, regret, all of that. I think that because boys learn to confide in women, that it was actually easier for them to talk to me because I was a woman than it might have been if I was an adult male.
And they had to volunteer and, to
yes,
talk
or
with
be
you.
They were asked. Some were asked, some volunteered. But yes, they did have to volunteer. So they were there for a reason. And, you know, a lot of times they were there because they had a particular story they wanted to tell me. You know, whether that story was about, you know, their attitude towards hookup culture, or whether it was about being a boy who was in love, or whether it was about being a boy who felt that he had been harmed, you know, sexually assaulted by a girl. There were boys who talked to me about unwanted sex, about girl, you know, having been drunk, you know, too drunk at a party, and a girl kind of took them and had sex with them, because erections do not equal consent. That's a physiological response. And they had not wanted that. And sometimes they weren't, you know, they were kind of philosophical about it, or they weren't, you know, that upset. But for a few guys, that was, especially if it was their first time, and especially if they had wanted that first time to feel meaningful to them and be with a partner they cared about, they were really devastated in very much the ways a girl would be. And it took me, I mean, that was a bias of mine. It took me a while to really hear what they were saying around that.
So how would you tell parents, suggest to parents, that they begin these conversations? I know you talked about starting very early, but if one hasn't done that kind of groundwork, mm-hmm. and your son, say, is about to go off to college, and that conversation has not yet taken place, what do you say?
Well, I mean, that's why I wrote the book. was that I really did want it to be a tool. I mean, that's what it's for. And listening to, you know, a show like this with your son offers opportunity to have these conversations. I mean, you have to start somewhere, and things. And I did an unusual for me thing with this book. In my previous books, this is my seventh book, and I had always ended by showing something that was illustrative of the ideas that I thought could be communicated. So, you know, profiling somebody or something like that. And I kept trying to do that with this book, and it wasn't working. And I realized that after 9 years of writing about adolescent sexuality, I had things to say. So I turned the last chapter into a script, but, you know, ideas and kind of a template of the sorts of conversations we need to have with boys. And many of them would work with girls as well. And the thing is, you know, it's not the talk. It's not one talk. I mean, if you were trying to teach your child table manners, you would not sit down and say, okay, you need to eat with a fork nicely, don't chew with your mouth open, put a napkin on, say please and thank you, excuse you, you know what I mean? And then think, okay, done my job, that'll be it, you know? That would never work. So it's a lot of small conversations about a lot of things that are about sex, but also about other things, about media, about gender dynamics that we can have over time. And one thing that was really clear in talking to the boys was that they wanted to hear more from their fathers or the whoever the male role model father figure was in their life, that if somebody talked to them about these issues, it was their mother. And they wanted to know more from their dads about sex, about relationships, about their father's own regrets. And I think that's a big ask for a lot of fathers, because obviously their own dads didn't do that. They may not have thought that much about contemporary ideas about consent or any of this, but if they can do it, you know, it would mean so much more to their sons. It's such an opportunity to deepen your relationship and create a different kind and model a different kind of masculinity and show them how to have hard conversations, because they're not going to be able to do it if we can't show them how.
Finally, I wonder how this whole process and writing this book has changed how you will talk with your own children.
It changes very much how I talk to, I have only one child, but how I talk to her. I can't be too specific because
I
long ago promised her that I would not talk about her
sure. On
the radio or in public. But we have long engaged in conversations. I mean, I think the first time that you and I spoke was when I wrote Cinderella Ate My Daughter, and that I wrote that book when she was in preschool, and it was about how the kind of girly girl culture was affecting young women. And so I had the opportunity with that to start scaffolding these conversations at a really young age, you know, of talking about things like we would watch animated movies and I'd say, hey, honey, you know, look, her eyes are bigger than her wrists. Are your eyes bigger than your wrists? Is your head bigger than your waist? I don't think so. Why do you think they draw them that way? You know, which I will say, I don't know that I would do that if I'd had a son. But we started conversations on that very elementary level, and we've been working on them all this time. She's an older teenager now. And I feel that those conversations have been really beneficial for her. And even more than that, I feel like they've been really beneficial for our relationship and establishing a kind of more open, honest, trusting relationship where she, I hope, feels she can talk to me, and also that paves the way for the kind of adult relationship I hope to have with her.
Peggy, thank you so much. You've written such an important book.
Thanks. Thank you, Diane. Thanks for having me on.
And that's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. Our engineer this week is Natalie Yurev-Lipker. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.